Then really glad to be here. Thank the organizers for the opportunity to talk here. I think I was chosen for this afternoon because what I have to say is very simple. And all the other things in this quantum landscape conference are so advanced that it's probably not for the large audience. But nevertheless, I enjoyed already my being here the last 2 days, and I will still enjoy it the other 2 days. I should say that I like this particular format and also the openness to different interpretations. Usually when I talk to people, well, in my community, whatever that is, it's very hard to talk about other things than Copenhagen. And here there's a number of different alternatives, maybe a little biased towards collapse models, but at least there are various views on the world, and I like that a lot, so we can discuss. And I learned already a lot. So what I can offer to you today is just humble experiments, so to say, so no brilliant theories, no alternatives to philosophy, although you will see there are some philosophical remarks also, but they are homegrown, so to say. I'm not a deep philosopher. So I can tell you about our experiments, and it's now a larger crowd around at the University of Vienna doing this, and there's a number of experiments. This is kind of a summary, but I won't go into the details here. So that's the number of systems and interferometers that we try to use for studying the quantum superposition principle with big things. And so what is the motivation for all that? And since this is a colloquium, I start very elementary. Both of you are familiar with that anyhow. But it will become sufficiently complex in the end. So let's see. So quantum physics is everywhere. That's the statement. And even there, the community is already split. What I list here is what some people call the old quantum physics, so to say. The fact that chemistry is based on quantum physics, that's kind of trivial, so to say. But also when you go to your doctor, when you have nuclear magnetic resonance tomography, you need the spin of the nuclei. And that is, of course, something very quantum. And you use that every day. Maybe not on yourself, but people do that. The effect that won Einstein the Nobel Prize, the photo effect, is what people use for collecting, for harvesting light, for producing energy. So photovoltaics is very common. The fact that you have Bose statistics in lasers, that the photon is a boson, that is what I use here for pointing, so to say. So we use that every day, quantum physics really working. And even when you drive through the area, so to say, and use your navigator, well, you wouldn't say that my mobile phone is a quantum instrument per se, but of course it uses quantum instruments, like the atomic clocks which are circulating around the Earth. And without understanding quantum mechanics, you would, of course, not understand the atomic clock, not time, not GPS. And there are many things, and very fashionable nowadays is also to look into more complex systems, biological systems, and to wonder where quantum effects may play a role, a significant role. So all that is more or less known. And there's no reason, if you just look at that, if you're interested in technology, in this kind of technology, then there's no fundamental reason to worry about philosophy. But on the other hand, we all know that there's a number, and that's only a small list, a number of items in the comparison between the classical worldview of what we experience in our everyday life and quantum mechanics that still keeps us scratching our heads. And that is in particular the quantum superposition principle, which Feynman once thought to be at the heart of quantum mechanics. And then some people would say, well, this does not include entanglement, but of course it does. It's many particle superposition. So quantum superposition is really what is strange. Although we are always, we've been familiar already with superpositions in our everyday world, with water waves, electromagnetic waves, and whatsoever, the strange thing is, or we perceive as strange, that seemingly a single particle can be in a superposition of various positions, energies, spin states, whatever. And assigning reality to this thing, that's also at the heart of many discussions here, whether there's some ontology or epistemology to be understood in the context of quantum mechanics, that is still an open question. And if you allow me to say that, many times this today and yesterday, the word ontology came up. And if I talk about these things in other other conferences, well, some colleagues would rather say that this is a case for brain oncology, so to say, that you shouldn't worry about ontologies. Still, it's interesting to think about whether the wave function is something real or whether it's just our measure for knowledge, for information, and so forth. And that is also what keeps my group busy, so to say, to wonder about and to worry about what is real and what is potentiality, so to say. Although in the lab, we, of course, can only handle the real things. And therefore, most of the experimentalists are kind of split in their minds. Of course, we know that there are difficulties with the term reality and also with locality and with causality, depending on how you look at it. But of course, when you set up a vacuum machine, you have real things and real screws to turn. Huh? All right. So, and what is the second motivation? The second motivation next to understanding the foundations of physics is that there are emergent technologies coming up. And on the one hand, and that is related to what we are doing, so matter waves as such are interesting and useful things, as, well, nowadays one has to call it quantum sensors, but they're just intelligent instruments which can be used for measuring either ultra-weak magnetic fields, like in superconducting quantum interference devices with electrons. Atoms are nowadays very advanced. Atom interferometers are very well advanced as sensors for little g, the Earth's gravitational acceleration, which is interesting if you want to search for oil, for caves, for whatever, natural resources, but also for testing fundamental physics. And the molecular interferometers that I'm going to show to you, they are currently mostly, if we talk about technological applications, they're mostly in physical chemistry. We can learn additional information about molecular properties, internal molecular states, while using these particles in matter wave interferometers. A thing that I'm not going to talk about is, of course, quantum computers, because we are not doing quantum computation, but that is something that is closely related to the question whether there's what the nature of the wave function is and how you can use that, how you can exploit that. So there's quantum computation, simulation, cryptography, and whatsoever. And finally, again, quantum complexity in living systems, that's also an open and emergent question. But I can focus only on this one, on matter waves here and now, because it's so simple and because we can do that in the lab. And the question is, how macroscopic can a system be and still show quantum behavior? And many experimentalists have looked at various systems. So on the one hand, there's the electron system, a superconducting quantum interference device with several 10 to the, whatever, 14 electrons in a coherent state circulating left and right around this topological defect, if you wish. So the big many, many body coherent quantum system, mesoscopic, medium cold, millikelvin to Kelvin. And some people think that this is already the most macroscopic quantum system that you can have because there are so many electrons involved. Other people would say this is not the case because the electrons are not really separated, but that's a matter of debate. But it's an interesting system at any rate to study. Hundreds of groups, meanwhile, are working on Bose-Einstein condensates, quantum degenerate ultra-cold atomic systems. And again, all these atoms are in a coherent state. They all do the same thing, more or less. But it's not a noon state. It's not in the sense that you have all the atoms here and none here and vice versa. It's not a quantum superposition of something macroscopic. It's many, many atoms, but all doing the same thing and operated at very low temperatures, between 1 picokelvin up to microkelvin for light atoms. So if you do a quantum interference experiment, a matter wave experiment with Bose-Einstein condensates, you will always see the de Broglie wave of a single atom, not of the entire BEC, unless you prepare a noon state or a Schrödinger cat, which is still difficult to do. More recently, a number of groups, I would say a handful of groups, have started working on trapping and optically cooling mesoscopic spheres, 100 nanometer, a few hundred nanometer diameter, with the goal to finally bring them to the ground state of a trap. This is an optical trap in this case. That's, by the way, a picture of Lukas Novotny from Rochester, and now 88. So they can trap things, they can cool things, but they're still away, a good way away from being to the quantum ground state in this harmonic oscillator trap. And the idea is then, in some groups, also to study not only the quantum ground state, but to do some quantum interference experiments once you have them as cold as you can, and release the spheres and do some interference with them. But that's not yet been done. So it's a dream for the future. And we are also partially working on that in our group. Competing with that, but at a much higher mass range, is micro and nano oscillators, which you nowadays can cool electronically, optically, using various techniques, even cryogenically, to the mechanical ground state. So this little pendulum is then really acting like a quantum pendulum. And you can bring them to the ground state, that's extremely exciting. But a certain number of tests that we're interested in cannot be done with that. So for instance, CSL tests, I think, cannot be done. So continuous spontaneous localization tests cannot be done. Because the quantum superposition of these cantilevers is necessarily very tiny, because the ground state of such a harmonic oscillator extends to square root of h bar over m omega. And since the mass is so high, the extension of the ground state is very tiny. And that is what we're interested in. So mesoscopic, molecular, covalently bound systems, not necessarily covalent, it could be other bindings as well, but complex systems, which are at the interface between the classical world and the quantum world in various senses. So on the one hand, in terms of what you can do with them already, so you can prepare them in quantum states, and at the same time, they're internally as hot as any classical body would be. This element here, for instance, that is a perfluoroalkyl functionalized tetraphenyl porphyrene with a long name that I wouldn't mention here. But when we launch that into the gas phase, this guy has about 500 Kelvin internal temperature, so that's very hot. And still, we can see the delocalized quantum state, as you will see in the end, the delocalized quantum state of this thing. So it's in a completely different temperature regime than all the BEC and laser-cooled cantilever, laser-cooled nanospheres. So that's something very hot, and nevertheless, it shows quantum effects. And it, as you see, it also rotates, it vibrates. So there are many things that are interesting and exciting in these things internally. So that's what we are going to talk about today. And the goal here is, of course, to not to stop at, in this case, 10 to the 4 atomic mass units, but also to scale that up to things which can be a million mass units, 10 million, 100 billion, whatever, in the end. There will be a natural limit, and that's also what I would like to talk about today. I should probably point to that also, because all this is kind of testing the Schrödinger equation, which looks very simple, but which describes all non-relativistic quantum mechanics and a large fraction of our world. And when you go to Erwin Schrödinger's grave in Alpar, in Tirol, in Austria, it's written here on the stone. Actually, it's not a stone. It's an iron plate, so it's not written in stone. You can change it. And the question is whether one day one should add a little term here, whether quantum mechanics really, really holds. So, I don't know if Terry is here today, but actually, I promised to Schrödinger's daughter when I once met her that I would not paint on this thing. But of course, we hope, or maybe, I'm not sure if I should hope for a possible change of the Schrödinger equation, but of course, it would be exciting to find a nonlinear term here. Nobody knows whether it's there. But at least one can look for it. And a number of people, I don't have to display Tony Leggett here because, in German at least, we would say carrying olds to Athens. I'm not sure if you say that in English, but if many people here would believe that there could be a change in quantum mechanics at a certain mass and complexity range, and that is what is summarized here also in Tony Leggett's statement. But nobody knows exactly what this change could be, and maybe there's none. And as experimentalists, we are free. We don't have to follow any ideology. We just do the experiments and see what happens. And so that's what we do. And what we are going to do is just elementary meta-wave interference. And that's very old, as you know. It starts all with these four letters, that the de Broglie wavelength is just given by Planck's constant m and v, the mass and the velocity. And as you know, this is more than 100, about 100 years old, starting in 1923, first experiments in 1927, and actually even the first atom and molecule experiments, diffraction experiments in 1930 by Esterman and Stern. So that was very early, but then there was a long silence. Nobody talked about matter waves, at least not very many people, until laser cooling came up, until nanofabrication came up, until people could handle these things. And nowadays, everything is much easier, of course. Again, this is still the simple part. So why, what would we be looking for if we wanted to see wave phenomena in quantum mechanics? That's not quantum mechanics, what I'm showing here, huh? But that's the idea of what you look for, what you should watch out for. Huh? You should look for interference patterns. Here, a plane wave is coming onto this double slit, and the double slit has the elementary wavelets which amplify or interfere constructively or destructively in certain places. And in the end, at the screen, whatever that will be, you expect to see some interference pattern. That's all we want to see in order to prove there's interference. And interference with single particles is then, so to say, the quantum part. This is not single particle interference. This is 10 to the 20, whatever, water molecules interference. And nobody is puzzled by just the wavelets in your bathtub. But if you do it with single molecules, either single water molecules or bigger and bigger things, then it's kind of puzzling because, as you will see, nobody knows what locality and reality really mean in this case. So that's what we plotted in the very early years when we started, together with Anton Zeilinger, I should say, in 1999, the first fullerene experiments. And fullerenes are little balls of carbon which look really like soccer balls, 60 carbon atoms arranged in the shape of a soccer ball. Another question is if you can do experiments with soccer balls that resemble the interference pattern or the interference experiment that we have seen with the water. And then there's a little point that I would like to point out, which is sometimes wrong in textbooks. So it's important to see that here. So the little player is shooting the ball towards the goal, and there's the brick wall in between, one gate open. And there's already one thing which is puzzling, namely that the distribution here is relatively large. Huh? There are many explanations for that. If you have a real brick wall, there could be scattering inside the brick wall. But if it's infinitely thin, the distribution should be smaller, and it's broader because quantum mechanics, the uncertainty principle is essentially broadens this up already, huh? Because a small delta x leads to a large delta p, and that translates into a larger delta x on the screen. So far, no puzzle. Same if you open the right-hand gate, just a little bit shifted. And then if you open both, the puzzle is not that you get three peaks, but that you get two positions here in this case where there's no ball. So the absence of amplitude, that is what is really puzzling, because there are more possibilities. So it can go through here and through there. And still, there are fewer possibilities of there's a smaller amplitude to land at a certain position in the goal. And that tells us somehow, at least if you, so that makes us question the notion of reality or locality, or either one or both. And I know that Bill Unruh doesn't like non-locality, and it's not non-locality in the sense of what people in Bell experiments talk about, but at least something is fishy with what we understand of our world. And that's why so many people are sitting here, that we don't understand that really. And that's the simplest case where you can show that. And we try to show that now for various molecules and various circumstances. So this is, of course, when you try to do that in the macroscopic world with a real soccer ball, 20 centimeters or so, this wouldn't work. But we did that first with very, very tiny soccer balls, the fullerenes, and now also with larger things. And the question is, how can we visualize that in the lab? How can we really do an experiment to prove that such phenomena exist? And, well, the experiment is as simple as you would imagine it, as you would set it up after the first year in physics. You need two double slits, so to say, and that is made here. You need somehow to prepare a wave. We have to talk about that. And you need a screen. So what is that in reality? In reality, our soccer player, so to say, we need to launch the molecule somehow. And the question is how to do that. And in many cases, we still do that thermally. You can do that in an oven. You can just cook your molecules, so to say, evaporate them, and then thermally they come out. For various reasons, we prefer to use a focused diode laser, which is focused to a micrometer, 1.3 or so. a blue diode laser which evaporates the molecules very locally. Now, this prepares already a certain spatial coherence. So we have to talk about various wave phenomena. On the one hand, the wavelength, the de Broglie wavelength, the transverse coherence, and the longitudinal coherence. The de Broglie wavelength, as mentioned already before, is given by H over mv. In this case, these molecules, which I haven't shown yet, but which are here, phthalocyanines is a certain dye molecule. These molecules have a mass of about 500 and something atomic mass units. And so if they leave the surface here with a velocity of about 150 meters per second, they have a de Broglie wavelength of the order of a few picometers, 3, 4, 5 picometers, depending on the velocity. That's very tiny. Picometer is 10 to the minus 12. That's much smaller than the diameter of this molecule, which is 2 nanometers. So it's very, very tiny. And then if you talk about the transverse and longitudinal coherence, that is given by the Fourier transform either of the position for the longitudinal, for the aperture, so where the source emits the molecules. That gives you the transverse coherence. And the Fourier transform of the velocity distribution gives you the longitudinal coherence. Now, in both cases, it's a thermal start, and therefore the coherence properties are lousy, relatively lousy, compared to Bose-Einstein condensates, for instance. So in this case, the transverse coherence expands because of the expansion of the wave function. The uncertainty principle, if you wish, imposes a certain, so you restrict the origin, and therefore the momentum is spread. The momentum spreads out and gives a certain width of the wave packet in a meter distance behind the source. And that amounts to a few hundred nanometers. It's not very big, but sufficiently big to cover a few slits in the grating. And the longitudinal coherence is given by the spectral distribution, the thermal velocity distribution. And since that is very limited, the longitudinal coherence is also limited to a few 10 picometers, 10, 20, depending on how well you select the velocity. So all this is very, very tiny. Well, you can, but that's more a joke, say that all these properties, the de Broglie wavelength coherence, transverse coherence, and longitudinal coherence, at the start, they're sitting here where there's no atom, huh? Because these are all descriptions of the center of mass motion, and the center of mass is there where there's no atom. But anyhow, so this is the phthalocyanine, and the diffraction element is a grating, a nanograting in this particular case. Later, we will have other things. This is a silicon nitride grating, 100 nanometer period, 50 nanometer opening, 10 nanometers thickness. Very, very tiny. Transmission. Purely, so it's open slits. The black lines, these are the open slits. It's 10 nanometers, very delicate. But we haven't destroyed too many, actually. So one or two, yes, but they survive. It's difficult to make 5 nanometers. So colleagues in Israel are working on that. And actually, we would like to go for graphene, so single atom layer thickness. And that is still on the challenging side, but not impossible. So these are transmission gratings. But you're right, the thickness is as much as 5 diameters of the molecule. It's not a lot. No, fortunately and unfortunately, they don't. The collimation that you impose here in order to prepare a sufficiently good wavefront, so to say, that is so strict that there are not very many molecules going through. So a monolayer would really take, well, a few months, I would say. The question was whether the molecules would clog up the slit. And when the grating is really thick and you work for very long, they do. But so over the time, they can change a bit. But after a while, so a few monolayers, if you leave them alone, they can also evaporate after a while. Not very rapidly, actually. Okay, but that's the setting. And then the molecules, they fly through the vacuum. Of course, they have to fly through the vacuum to be unperturbed. And they land on the screen. The screen is just a quartz plate. And the quartz plate captures the molecules. They sit. That's kind of that surprised ourselves, so to say, that they don't move. But in this particular case, after plasma cleaning, they just stay put where they are. And then you can use the laser to excite them and look at single molecule fluorescence, if you're lucky. So the goal is to see really every single molecule coming and forming the interference pattern in the end. So, and that's what we did. You see the CCD camera picture for two molecules sitting next to each other in a certain distance of about 5 microns. But you see also that you can localize each individual molecule much better than to Abbé's diffraction limit, actually in this case to about 10 nanometers, because you see the point spread function of each fluorescent dot, so to say, and you can fit that and fit the center very well to about 10 nanometers. So you can localize the molecule very well once it's on the screen. And it doesn't matter whether you do it when it's landing or just 10 minutes or 1 hour later, so they're sitting on the screen, they stay there. So if you wish, the measurement is already done by the interaction with the quartz slide, and we only image that then in afterwards. So this is a time series integration for 10 seconds, and wait a while, and another 10 seconds, wait a while, and so forth. And this picture is only to prove that we really have single molecule sensitivity, because after a while, one of these two guys disappears completely. So it's not just fading away exponentially, it's really gone. And the reason for that can be twofold. There are photochemical processes which bleach the molecule, and since it's only one, it can be dark immediately. On the other hand, since we are illuminating the glass screen with a laser, it can actually also heat the molecule off, like it's doing in the source. So, but the disappearance of one molecule here tells us that these are really two individual molecules sitting there and waiting for being discovered. And so now you can take that as a basis and form the interference pattern. And this is now a movie looking at individual points. You see, as a function of time, each individual molecule coming randomly, and that's the basis for the discussion about objective randomness, so to say. We cannot predict by any means where the next molecule will land, but we know with certainty what stripes we have to expect, because that's governed by the Schrödinger equation. And that's just the diffraction pattern in the far field that you would expect. And so you have both, if you wish, in one and the same picture, the single particle nature of the molecules and at the same time the ensemble deterministic Schrödinger equation evolution. And the fact that these stripes are spread out like fingers, that is because we have a velocity distribution, and the slow ones, they arrive at the bottom of the screen, they just fall a bit further, and the fast ones, they arrive a bit higher on the top. They didn't have so much time to spread out their wave function, therefore the interference pattern is a bit narrower than on the bottom. That's actually a movie online, but I won't show that here. And then there's, of course, always the debate, what is the reality of the molecule while it's flying through the apparatus? We cannot really trace it while it's flying through the apparatus. If we tried that, there wouldn't be any interference. But we can nevertheless, and that keeps me scratching my head, we can say something about the integrity of the molecule. Because so it's not anything smeared out, so to say. It's not that the polarizability, that the matter, the electrons, the nucleons, they're not smeared out over the grating, and we can, well, many of you would not even expect that, but some would. And we can show that by studying this interference pattern. So that's just a projection, if you wish. Wait a minute. Oops. So if you cut a slice here and plot the intensity, the fluorescent intensity is a function of position, then you find this. And so that looks perfectly nice, like a double slit interference pattern with a certain open fraction. But in order to understand the amplitude of the first side lobe, you need to include an effect which is actually a big nuisance if you want to extrapolate that to larger molecules, and that is van der Waals forces. The molecules are highly polarizable, and in particular, they are also anisotropically polarizable, and they rotate. But the polarizability is already one thing. So when they are next to the wall and they stay only for 100 picoseconds in flight through the wall, it's a very short interaction time. But in this very short interaction time, there's enough time for spontaneous charge fluctuations on the molecule, which induce charge fluctuations in the wall. That's the essence of van der Waals forces. And so the attractive van der Waals force, they induce a phase shift, and this phase shift appears as a change in the amplitude distribution of the fringes. It cannot change the period of the fringes, that's given by the geometry, but the phases can change the amplitude distribution. And so we always have to include a smaller diameter, smaller slit width, if you wish, effectively. And that's quite a significant effect. It reduces the effective slit width by a factor of 2. So instead of 50 nanometers, it looks as if it was 25 nanometers open. And but it's always the polarizability of the entire molecule. It's not half the molecule. It's not one quarter, one third. Nothing smeared out. In each individual slit, you have to assume there's the full polarizability, the full mass, everything. And that's kind of what puzzles us with our notion of reality. Huh? So how can that be? How can it be in all places? That's kind of the philosophical, my little homegrown philosophical summary. Huh? So these are the parameters, the 2 nanometer diameter, the 5 picometer wavelength. And I should say that the molecules are all distinguishable. So none of the subsequent following molecules are indistinguishable one with respect to the other. Of course, they have the same construction. It's the same chemical sum formula, the same geometry, but they all are highly excited in vibration and rotational states. And it's extremely unlikely to have 2 following molecules in the same internal state. And also orientation and spin and everything. So for that reason, they are all some of the same kind, but still completely distinguishable. There's no, you couldn't do a Henbury-Brown-Twiss experiment with 2 of them. And the second statement I made already, it's always the entire molecule which interacts with the surroundings, with the environment. And still everything is delocalized and information about all the open slits is available. The van der Waals force is also the reason why it's difficult to extrapolate this to really big things. If we want to test continuous spontaneous localization, a mass of 500 AMU is probably not what these guys in the front would like to have. So we have to go to bigger molecules. The question is how to do that. And there's another restriction. In order to prepare a sufficiently extended transverse coherence, we had to collimate. And collimation means throwing away most of your signal. So the question was, how can you work? So either you can cool, and so far nobody can do that on this planet, really efficiently cool big molecules or other things. And if you cannot cool these things, how can you work or live with the fact that they are uncooled, they're transversely incoherent in the first place? And that is why we implemented what we now call the Kapitsa-Dirac-Talbot-Lau interferometer. So it's a machine which is composed of 3 quantum optical elements, if you wish. And it's named after these 4 persons, Kapitsa, Dirac, Talbot, and Lau, because Kapitsa and Dirac thought about electron diffraction at standing light wave gratings already in the early 30s of the last century. And Talbot and Lau, in different centuries, actually thought about near-field diffraction phenomena that we also use. And the idea is now the following. You start with a source, no matter what source it is. And for different types of molecules, we need different sources and also different detectors. So here, this is still a thermal, a Knudsen cell, we would say, an oven. And that is a mass spectrometer, in particular, quadrupole at the moment. But the important quantum elements are these 3 things, so to say. So a mechanical grating, an optical grating, and a mechanical grating. So what is the purpose of these 3 things? Let's have a look at this designer's artist's view. So the molecules come as an extended, incoherent, transversely incoherent cloud. Actually, it's a continuous beam in most of our experiments, but there's no phase relation between the molecules whatsoever. So we have to impose something to make them quantum. And we do that by selecting certain positions. So the first grating is a coherence preparator in the sense that in each individual slit here, you select a Huygens wavelet, in quotations, and they spread out, and they cover then a few of the following, not in this case slits, but grating structures. And the grating structure is not a mechanical structure any longer because we want to avoid van der Waals forces. So it's an optical grating, a phase grating. A laser retroreflected at a mirror forms a standing light wave, in this particular case with a period of 266 nanometers. And so there's an intensity maximum, minimum, with a period of 266 nanometers. And I come back to that in a minute. But because of this spatial and periodic phase modulation, and if you set the distances and the periods of the gratings properly, in particular in this Talbot distance, which is governed by the grating period squared divided by the de Broglie wavelength itself. If you set this up in this way, then you get a lensless self-imaging of the grating. That is what Talbot effects are made for, lensless self-imaging. People in ultrasound technology, in X-ray technology, they're using this also because they don't have lenses. They use gratings and near-field phenomena for imaging. And we use that also here for the molecules. So there's an interference pattern coming up, which has the same period as the transmission there. So the density pattern here is reproduced on the screen, if you wish. But in some experiments, we don't use screens because for various reasons. But you can nevertheless sample the pattern by scanning a third grating and looking at the transmission behind the grating. So, and that's what we do in this particular experiment. So we scan the third grating and look at the transmission. And as a function of the position of the grating, we then find the transmission that reveals the interference pattern. And in this case, we don't expect the shape, the distribution that you saw also in the water wave example. Here we always expect to see something either sinusoidal or a little bit more trapezoidal. But at least it should have the same period as the grating. And that works very nicely, and it has a big advantage. It has the advantage that you can start here with 1,000 or 5,000 collimation slits in parallel. And also your detector is massively parallel because you have 5,000 slits which all detect the molecules. So the signal is orders of magnitude larger than in the far-field diffraction experiment. And that was really the enabling step for all we have been doing since 2003, more or less. And of course, the Talbot effect is very old, but the implementation into atom interferometry, that is that we owe to John Clauser, who did it first with, I think, potassium in atoms. Clauser actually did many things, in quantum information and in meta-wave interferometry. And now the question is, what can you study with this kind of interferometer? And this is what one of the molecules that we like and looked at. We call it the molecular octopus because it has eight arms. It's a carbon nanosphere like a buckyball, and then eight perfluoroalkyl functionalized chains. Huh? It's a molecule which is as massive as a little protein, for instance, as insulin. It has the same mass as insulin, except for 10 atomic mass units or so. And as you see, it's rotating, it's vibrating. And the question, of course, was, does that still show interference? Does that still delocalize? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes, and even with a high contrast. I don't know if you can see that, but this has a visibility, the fringe visibility here of almost 50%. And that is as good as we expected it to be. So there's no decoherence, no dephasing. As you can see, very hard to get good signal to noise because these very big molecules, they don't like to fly. It's very hard to bring them into this beam in the first place. But once they're flying, they show very nice quantum interference. And now you may wonder, and occasionally we get this question, well, is it really quantum interference that we see? When you look through your fingers, take your hands like that, you also see bright and dark stripes. Seeing bright and dark stripes by itself is not a sign of quantum interference. It's also a Moiré effect. So you have to make sure that you don't mistake a Moiré effect for a quantum phenomenon. And so we do that by plotting what we expect from a classical Moiré effect, including all van der Waals forces and everything. That is the green line. And compare that to what quantum mechanics tells us, including, again, laser intensities and everything, laser beam profiles and everything. And that is the blue line. And clearly, the experiments are only compatible with quantum mechanics here. So we're relatively confident that everything is fine with quantum mechanics here. And we did that also for currently the largest guy so far, the molecule that I briefly showed in the very first slide. And even this guy has a very high contrast, quantum fringe pattern. And again, we can do the game, compare the classical and quantum pattern. But this was so difficult to get. Chemists in Basel, Marcel Mayer and friends, they had to synthesize this molecule for us. And it took them weeks to synthesize a few milligrams. That's a separate story. But here, chemistry is really important for us. And therefore, we couldn't repeat the experiment many, many times. So we had to live with the points we had. but they're clearly in discrepancy with classical mechanics and fit very nicely to our quantum expectations. But still, the chemists give us a hard time accepting such a paper in any chemistry journal, simply because they don't believe that this is possible. And so we are still fighting, but in the end, I have to print it somewhere on my house wall or so, because the chemists don't believe that. So what shall I say? Anyhow, we sometimes say and claim that this guy here, that this is the biggest Schrödinger cat man has ever made. Actually, it was a woman as a PhD student. And the question is whether this is a fair claim. And of course, when we talk to our friends, and we're really friends in Paris, Serge Roche, Michel Brun, Jean-Michel Raymond, they had the first Schrödinger cat with photons. Of course, they claim that a real cat needs two things. On the one hand, it needs states which are macroscopically distinct. And on the other hand, it should be, well, this macroscopically distinct thing, a macroscopic object, should be coupled to something very elementary. And let's briefly see how that relates to Schrödinger's original example and then to our own experiment. So you may all recall that Schrödinger's original cat looked something like that, copied here from Wikipedia. That was not Schrödinger's drawing, huh? Where the radioactive atom may decay and or not decay and trigger a mechanism which would release the hammer, which would open the flask, release the poison, kill the cat. And it could either do it or not. And if you replace or by either or by and, then you're in the quantum situation. So in the end, the cat would be dead and alive. But there are two aspects. On the one hand, what Schrödinger originally wanted to show is that quantum mechanics intrinsically runs into a problem, that you get macroscopic superpositions that we don't see in our daily life. And this we can realize in the lab. So we can realize this quantum mechanical macroscopic superposition of things which are composed of 800 atoms in a single molecule, separated by a micrometer, a bit less. They are even hotter than a cat would ever be, 500 Kelvin, and the cat would be dead. But the molecules are still okay. So from that point of view, it's a very good example of Schrödinger's cat. But it does not have this coupling to the elementary quantum system, not the atom that decays. That is missing here. And that is, for instance, what Serge Roche has in his experiment. that is our claim. Huh? So that is our Schrödinger cat, the molecule in a semi-realist view. I don't know how to plot that properly. Huh? There's no way to plot that properly. But the molecule somehow explores all the spaces at the same time and interferes in the back. And there is entanglement also in the experiment, but this entanglement is a nuisance, so to say. Because if the molecule flies through the machine and hits an external nitrogen molecule in the vacuum chamber at 10 to minus 8 millibars, there's always a little nitrogen molecule flying around. It actually produces an entangled state. Because depending on whether the nitrogen molecule collided here or there, this generates something like that. We cannot use that as a resource, so to say. We cannot exploit that for quantum information processing, would be nice, because we cannot trace the position of the nitrogen molecule. Maybe we can invent something with cold atoms, directed atoms, and look in certain scattering angles, but that is for future experiments. so far, everything is in perfect agreement with what quantum mechanics would tell us. So, of course, we ask ourselves also what are really the limitations. And I see a number of different things that would really limit the observation of quantum superposition states. I call that kinematics, decoherence, phase scrambling, and limits of quantum mechanics. The limits of quantum mechanics, that's what most people in the conference are sitting for here, whether or not there's a little term added to the Schrödinger equation or anything else. So. but there are trivial reasons also. Kinematics is a very obvious one, huh? So that's the Ferrari, huh? Okay, if you take this car, it has a very high mass, it's very fast, therefore the de Broglie wavelength is extremely tiny. It is so tiny, that the diffraction angle would be 10 to the minus 39 radians. No way to see that. Because if you wanted to do that, you would need the size of 30 trillion times the size of the universe. That's a bit extensive, huh? And it would also be hard to get, say, 10,000 Ferraris funded by our funding agency to do the experiment. So that's very hard. That's obvious, and that's the most trivial reason that we can think of. Oops, sorry, again the sound. But there's a more fundamental, reason also, and that is decoherence. And decoherence is universally accepted because it's in the theory, it's in the part of the Schrödinger equation. If you couple something to a previously isolated quantum object to its environment, the quantum information it carries is diluted into the environment, and locally you lose this kind of information. And the strange thing is that even a single 4-meter radio frequency photon, very extended radio frequency photon, would destroy coherence of this Ferrari, and that for three different reasons. One reason is the argument that if you get which way information, which path information, then you lose interference. That's Bohr's original argument. And which path information you can get when the wavelength here is twice the separation between the two slits. Okay, that's one. But then Heisenberg comes and says, well, if I try to measure with a photon where the Ferrari is, then of course I will have a recoil. And this recoil scrambles my interference pattern because it's a random direction of the photon coming from all sides for each Ferrari. Therefore, altogether, if I take the ensemble will be scrambled. And then some of the decoherence theorists come and say, well, this doesn't play a role. The Ferrari is so massive, the recoil can be neglected. And I would like to point out that this is wrong. It can never be neglected, not in any pure de Broglie experiment. There's always a recoil, and it's always the crucial element. We're not talking about coupling to internal states. That would change the issue. But as long as you have only center of mass motion, the only information you can get is by transmitting momentum. And that is what's happening. So if you look at the original tiny diffraction angle of 4×10⁻¹⁹ radians, a single photon kicks the Ferrari by the half angle, so to say, from the maximum to the minimum. And so that will always scramble the interference pattern. And the third argument is also valid. By scattering the photon at the Ferrari, you entangle the photon with the car, so you make the Ferrari a classical car by shining light on it. And that's probably why you see so many brilliant lamps shining on Ferraris in expositions. Huh? It's a classic car. But that's the three reasons for us to see how quantum mechanics transforms into classical physics. If you think in this decoherence world. And we did some experiments to show that for large molecules, medium-sized molecules, I should say, nowadays, that were still with fullerenes. And we had a Talbot-Lau interferometer, but with three material gratings. That doesn't play a role here. But again, the first grating prepares coherence. The second one does the diffraction. The third one samples the interference pattern. And then we look at the fringe contrast. The fringe contrast as a function of how many collisions we can have. So how often comes a molecule which hits our fullerene. And you can see that as a function of pressure, this is 10⁻⁷ millibars. So that's already 10 orders of magnitude lower pressure than here, ambient pressure. And as a function of this increasing pressure, you see how the fringe visibility decreases. And that tells us if we want to do quantum interference with a virus, with a gold cluster, 50 nanometers or something like that, you really have to get to really good pressures, 10⁻¹ⁱ, 10⁻¹⁰ millibars. And if it should be a 100 nanometer particle, it's close to 10⁻¹⁵ millibars. So very good pressures that you need. But there's another effect also, and that is scattering of thermal photons. They could come from outside, they could come from inside. And here we were looking at photons from the inside. So we can heat certain molecules, in particular the fullerenes, because they're so stable, to very high temperatures, but only for very short times. And if you do that, they re-radiate a little bit blackbody radiation here, which we cannot detect, it's too little intensity. But when they're flying through the interferometer, they can occasionally also emit a photon. And if they do that, it's again which path information, they say hello to the world and the interference is gone. And we can calculate the internal temperature of the molecule. They're already so complex that you can give them an internal temperature. And when they're internally 1,500 Kelvin hot, the contrast is essentially disappearing. So this interaction with the environment, either by collisions or by thermal radiation, that is crucial for many experiments and is a big challenge for big things. And if you take the extreme ourselves, so to say, standing here in, at atmospheric pressure, you can easily compute that you will be hit by 10 to the 28 nitrogen molecules per second. That's really a lot, huh? Because they're fast, there are many of them, you're big. So you're actually localized by breathing. Huh? And that's it. Huh? So there's no way for us to delocalize. And the same here, I'm irradiated by so many different photons, and I emit photons all the time, so I cannot get away. Huh? But this is all the external perturbations. There's also an internal aspect to all of that. I'm frequently asked, how come that the... So if the molecule is really thermally excited to rotational states, vibrational states, it can change conformations. So why does that not destroy the interference pattern? Actually, in the very beginning, when we applied for money, the referee said this is not going to work because the internal states, they are changing. So you don't get the money. And luckily, he was a friendly guy. We talked to him. There was an open reviewing process. And we could convince him that it would work, and it worked. And the reason is because the internal states decouple from the external states to a good degree. But having said this, we can nevertheless reveal or retrieve information about the internal state in this interferometer. And the story is as follows. So this is, again, a different artist's view of our Kapitza Dirac Talbot Law interferometer, where the first grating prepares the coherence, the second does the diffraction, and the third one does the sampling of the pattern. Now, if there's no field, no nothing, no external force, you see a certain molecular fringe when you scan the third grating. So far, so good. Everything is in agreement with quantum mechanics, and everything's fine. It remains within quantum mechanics, but nevertheless, you get a shift of the interference pattern if you apply external forces. And these forces could be inertial forces, like you rotate the machine, you have gravity. But there could be electrical fields, magnetic fields, photons absorbed. Absorbed photons don't destroy coherence. They're fully phase coherent. Only spontaneous re-emission is bad. So there are many, many different interactions which maintain coherence, but nevertheless shift the interference pattern. And that is something that you can exploit for doing physical chemistry. And in particular, so that is the shift that you expect. It's the external force, the time through the interferometer, actually from here to here squared, the mass and the grating period, they determine the frequency or the fringe shift, the phase shift. So if you want to build something very sensitive, you have to have something very slow so that the interaction time is long and the grating period should be small too. And I won't go into all the details. Actually, we had a long list of experiments with chemists. This is only one example that I would like to show you. This is a perfluoroalkyl functionalized diazobenzene molecule. We chose that because the chemist could make it and because it could easily fly. But if you do the simulation of what this thing does as a function of time, it evolves, it changes its shape, and it changes its electric dipole moment quite substantially by a factor of 300%. So it changes its electronic coupling to the environment while it's flying through the environment and coherently flying through everything. So the question was really, does that perturb quantum interference? And the surprising answer is no. You see full contrast, because there's no which path information. There's no recoil that depends on the internal state, so to say. It works. But the polarizability, or I should say the electric susceptibility, which is governed by the static polarizability and the projected dipole moment onto the electric field projected dipole moment, they enter the deflection force that I briefly mentioned. So if you add an external electric field, that is the E gradient E, but that doesn't matter for the moment. If you add the external field, this couples to the internal states, and you get a shift of the interference pattern depending on this internal property. So we see a shift which measures the internal temperature, if you wish, because that is temperature dependent, if we know the other properties. In this case, we know the temperature from the source, so we can derive something on the projected time average dipole moment of this molecule, which is information about the internal dynamics. Although the molecule is always delocalized, so we can look inside without looking at it, if you wish. And that works very well, and that can be used for a dozen of different molecular properties. electrical, magnetic, optical, ionization properties, and so forth. And that's a separate branch in my group now. I will skip that because that gets too detailed, but that is in particular interesting if you look into biomolecules in water, droplets, and things like that while they're flying through the interferometer. But maybe more fundamental, so to say, is the question, what does it do to the interferometer that we're standing here on Earth? And again, we are very sensitive to many effects, and that is the Earth's rotation and Earth's gravity. So once the molecules are released, they go through the interferometer, but they are isolated from the environment. So Earth is rotating underneath the interferometer. And that makes a small Coriolis shift or Sagnac shift, depending on what you would call it. And so this can be seen, although the Earth is rotating very slowly. And on the other hand, the fact that, well, if you tilt the interferometer slightly by a milliradian, that makes a height difference between two neighboring paths of a nanometer, one nanometer. So, and you still see the gravitational potential difference by one nanometer. That makes a significant shift. And that's actually a big problem for the experiments. Because if you have a velocity spread, the interaction time is different for different molecules, and they all get the same, they get a shift, but a different shift, and therefore the phase can be scrambled. So we have to make good velocity selection or find a different scheme. And, so that was one limitation. And then there's a long list of other possible limitations to quantum delocalization. That is maybe for the discussion. There's a number of spontaneous localization theories, but there are other gravity-related effects, which I would maybe like to discuss then in the discussion session. Otherwise, that takes too long. Just to conclude, more or less, I would like to introduce the most recent interferometer that we have. I don't know how I'm doing on time. Because there's something that we like nowadays to advertise as the ultimate interferometer. And because it's the ultimate interferometer, we wanted to call it optimally, like the optimal time domain, whatever interferometer, but then somehow we cut it to OTIMA, and so it's the optical time domain ionizing metawave interferometer. And I will explain in a minute what that is. And the idea is that this should work for atoms, for molecules, for clusters of molecules, for nanoparticles, essentially for everything that you can manipulate with a single photon. And it doesn't have to be ionization. It could be photodepletion, could be heating, there are various things. And so the idea is the following. Start with the Talbot-Lau configuration as before. So we want to make a three-grating interferometer as before. And the Talbot condition is that you have to set the gratings in such that the grating spacing, is the grating period squared divided by the de Broglie wavelength. But if you look precisely, the de Broglie wavelength has velocity in there. And if you divide by velocity, then this is a time, and this is a number. And that gives you a Talbot time. So you can devise an interferometer which does not depend on length separation anymore, but rather on time separation between the gratings. And now we only have to implement that with something that works as an absorptive grating, like a mechanical grating. And this absorptive grating is realized by a standing light wave in the vacuum ultraviolet region. So a VUV laser at 157 nanometers forms a standing light wave. And that photoionizes the particles in the antinodes, and it leaves them intact in the nodes. And so the grating period is very tiny, 80 nanometers. And so in principle, this can act as a mechanical grating, but it's optical, so there's no Van der Waals force. Now, we put that together to a big machine, which now has three lasers, complicated fluorine excimer lasers. And they're all back-reflected, the laser beams are back-reflected on a single mirror. Single mirror is good because they have all the same phase reference then. And then we have a source of molecules and clusters to be discussed, and they fly through. And finally, a detector mass spectrometer. And the idea is the following. So the molecules come. Actually, these are anthracene clusters. That is anthracene. And when you emit them from a supersonic expansion, they cluster to bigger things. anthracene 12, 15, 10, whatever. So in this bunch of molecules or clusters passes here the mirror. And when they're close to the edge, the first laser comes. And that is the first absorptive grating. So you extract the molecules from the antinodes and leave them in the nodes. Those in the nodes go on, they fly on. They're hit by another laser, same game. Ionization in the antinodes, transmission in the nodes. These are 5 or 6 nanosecond lasers, very short pulse. They go on, they're hit another time, again by a third laser. So that's our coherence preparation, diffraction, and detection in the end. And well, if we could shift this third laser beam, we could really scan the spatial interference pattern. But in the first round, we have to do something else. And what we do is we look at the mass spectrum of clusters that is transmitted here through the entire interferometer. And you see the signal as a function of mass. So there are many clusters formed at the same time. They all come with the same velocity. So you generate a de Broglie wavelength spectrum, if you wish, because they have the same velocity but different mass. And now as a function of de Broglie wavelength, you should expect a certain interference. And there will be clusters which do not fit the condition, the Talbot condition. So they will not show constructive interference. And there will be clusters that, that fit this condition here. And for them, there will be enhanced transmission through the interferometer. And you can see that by comparing a good interferometer configuration from a bad configuration where the pulses are asymmetric in time. Then you wouldn't expect any resonance, no enhancement, no transmission enhancement. And this is one particular cluster, the anthracene 10 cluster. And there you see enhancement when you set it to resonance and no enhancement when it's asymmetric. And now you can do that for various cluster types, and that will change or will scan effectively your de Broglie wavelength. So the mass scale here can be recalculated in a de Broglie wavelength scale, if you wish, because they all come with the same velocity. And then at a certain de Broglie wavelength, you see local enhancement, and there's complete suppression, and again, local enhancement. These are the Talbot orders, the interference orders, if you wish. Now, comparing that to a classical theory, that is a big challenge, because computing these anthracene clusters, the electronic properties of these anthracene clusters, that is difficult. And therefore, there are still some error bars in there. But it's clear that the classical gray shadowed bars here, they do not fit at all the green experimental curves. Whereas the violet theory is quite OK. There are still open questions with regard to the polarizability and ionization cross-sections of these clusters. But it's relatively clear that this is a quantum curve. And this scheme can be extrapolated to anything, even up to a gold cluster or silicon cluster, a million mass units massive. Maybe I should skip the details here and keep that for the questions. This is only to show that this is a universal scheme in the sense that, so the very first experiments were with anthracene, but then there were experiments with ferrocene, with caffeine, with vanillin, and with all of these things, you can interact the same way. It's an ionization grating, and you see these interference patterns. And currently, there's an experiment going on with atoms, with molybdenum atoms, to calibrate everything. And sooner or later, there should also be bioclusters and metal clusters. Now, since the claim is, and that's the last slide, more or less, that we can use that for super high mass interference. Also, the question is, what do we have to do? So a good grating period that you can make in the lab is 100 nanometers. That's either the standing wave period of a fluorine laser, or that's a nanomechanical grating, but about 100 nanometers. Now, the question is, where can you get, if you can cool the original sample, the velocity of the sample to 10 Kelvin, which is a cryogenic buffer gas cell, helium-cooled buffer gas cell. It's easy to compute the velocity, and you end up for a million mass units with a picometer de Broglie wavelength. A picometer de Broglie wavelength, that's a piece of cake, so to say, because most of the experiments nowadays run at 100 femtometers or 200 femtometers. So it's relatively easy to get a picometer. 15 femtometers is a challenge, but even that is not completely crazy. If you're already at 100 femtometers, 15 is not that far away, huh? And that is 10 to the 10 atomic mass units. So that sounds very easy, but in practice it's not. And the reason why it's not is that there's a Talbot time. There's the wave packet needs a certain time to spread out. And it's 30 milliseconds for a million mass units. That is okay. 30 milliseconds is easy. 3 seconds for 10 to the 8 atomic mass units. And, well, what do these things do in 3 seconds when you leave them alone, so to say? They drop. They drop a substantial distance. Huh? And if you go to 10 to the 10 mass units, that's 300 seconds. So there's no way to build any drop tower on this planet that would host that. So here you have really to go either to levitate things or in magnetic fields, electric fields, but without phase perturbation, or you have to go to microgravity, and that is why we also talk to ESA about these things. But that's very long. I mean, if you want to have a satellite, that's 20 or 30 years from now. Huh? And it's very expensive also. And that is really kind of the conclusion. We're also interested and got money for doing experiments with such things. Yesterday I was asked already whether we had rhinovirus interference already. The answer is no, not yet. And there's a good reason for that. The mass is very heavy, very massive, 7 megadaltons, 7 × 10⁶. In terms of mass, we are somewhere here. So I think GFP is close. The Ultima interferometer could, in terms of mass, easily go there. That is a challenge, but not impossible. Actually, a viroid is in the right mass range. But the biomolecules need special handling, and that is a long story by itself, so I keep that for questions. We skip that also. This is also for the questions, and this is also for the questions, and I come to the to the summary. So there's a number of things that we try in our labs at the moment. We have 3 different interferometers running. One is the far-field diffraction experiment, which was meant to be pedagogical, but which can also be used to measure molecular properties. That is our current mass record holder, the Kapitsa-Dirac-Talbot-Lau interferometer, with functionalized molecules in the mass range of about 10,000 mass units. That is the most recent interferometer, the OTIMA, as we call it, optical time domain ionizing interferometer, which in principle would be suitable for anything up to 10 to the 10 more or less mass units, but the sources are still very demanding. And since all that is so difficult, there's also a large team working on that. And since we're still more or less there are 2 groups now working on that. Hendrik Ulbricht in Southampton has also started a group, and 2 others in Karlsruhe and in India, actually, they are starting off, but not yet there. But since we have to make all our mistakes for ourselves, so to say, and we do that every day, we need a large team for that, and that's it. The names in detail, also the former. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
So we like to give students the chance to ask the first questions. So are there any students that have questions?
Thank you for your talk. So if I understand things correctly, your results have demonstrated that quantum mechanics holds even on scales involving these octopi particles, which is interesting because, I mean, as it's presently formulated, quantum mechanics can be applied to systems on all physical scales, even though there are some, including Leggett, as you point out, that think it's going to break. So that's very interesting, just from an operational point of view. However, it seems as if you've painted the results in a brush dipped in ontic paint, or as some at this conference might call ontic poison. And I'm thinking in particular of the repeated use of the word delocalization and the analogy drawn between the Schrodinger cat and the superposition of states. So one could imagine recasting those results in the light of a different interpretation. So my question is, would you agree with that, or do you see these results as providing support for an ontic interpretation of the quantum state?
No, that's the philosophical question, huh? And I don't even dare to answer, but since, so I can tell you my own worldview, but that doesn't have to be correct. So, as far as I understand, for instance, if you ask whether that is a proof for delocalization of ontological things, you could, of course, come and say, well, there's the de Broglie-Bohm theory, and that would see it differently. And I cannot dismiss this theory because it's the same mathematical model, so to say. I personally am probably also in a superposition state of different interpretations, so that is very hard. I tend to say this is proof for delocalization because delocalization of something. I wouldn't necessarily say, let's maybe go into detail. So the molecules must have information. So information is delocalized. Otherwise, we cannot explain the interference pattern. But whether the molecule, obviously the molecule isn't smeared out either because we see it at every place indirectly because all its properties are needed to interact with the local environment. That would rather speak in favor of the de Broglie-Bohm theory, so to say, that you have always an intact particle everywhere, so to say. But it gets the information from everywhere. So something is delocalized. And I admit that my use of language is probably not very clean and pure, simply because I don't know which interpretation is right. So I try to get around that. I just see there's delocalized something.
Any other student questions? Okay, so maybe we'll throw open the floor to questions from non-students as well as from students.
All right, thank you very much for the talk. I enjoyed it very much. Actually, it's great to see what you can actually do in the lab, right, about those things. So I have a couple of questions. First of all, I'm curious about what in one of the last slides you showed different systems that you can consider, like including viruses. What was the unit of mass that we use there? Because I'm not familiar with it.
I hear that is, where is it? This is Dalton. It's essentially atomic mass units. The chemists call it Dalton. Huh?
All right, but just one question. There's another one. When you talked about basically a localization or a spontaneous localization induced by environment, right? And you were talking about a man, for example, with a characteristic size of, let's say, 2 meters or so. And you said that, well, yes, I mean, you have 10 to the 28, or I don't remember exactly the number, collisions of nitrogen atoms, right, or molecules per second. Well, that shouldn't be like the most important contribution to the localization, right? Because you see astronauts in orbit, right? And those are pretty localized as well, within nanometers, right? So not for being in the vacuum or in darkness, you wouldn't be localized, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't give it a hierarchy, so to say. So, of course, they're localized by being connected to their spaceship, so to say. That's probably even more important. But if you had nothing else but collisions, they would do it on a very rapid time scale.
I see.
And scattered light, the same. Huh?
Yeah. And then the last thing that I want to mention, you mentioned that one of the molecules that you used or you plan to use or you're working with is very difficult to synthesize, right? What are the reasons that actually force you to use one molecule over other, right?
It
would be easier.
Yeah, that's a very important question for us in the lab. So you have to bring them into the gas phase. They have to fly somehow. And if you try that simply with these molecules, for instance, you cannot heat them. If you heat a hemoglobin, it will denature and afterwards it will fragment. So it will not fly just by heating. And so we were looking for something that you can still heat just thermally in an oven or with a laser, and that still flies. And it turns out that if you give an organic molecule a shell of fluorine atoms, the fluorine atoms have a high electronegativity, so they bind the electrons, which reduces the polarizability, which makes them less binding to each other, so to say. So a high fluorine content is very good, and that's what the chemists provided. And that can still go on for quite a while. I think they can go up to 100,000. They themselves don't believe that it will work. They're uncertain as we are, but I think it can still go on to 100,000 thermally. Yes, microphone is still coming.
You mentioned something quite, well, several things were very, very interesting, but one I was struck. You said that the tilt of your device, of your grading was enough for you to see the gravitational phase shift in the molecules. So what would it take for you to convert that to a gravity gradiometer? Could you measure the gradient of the gravitational of G? I mean, tidal. Could you see tidal forces using something of this sort?
The answer is yes and no. In principle, definitely yes, because it's the same concept as in atom interferometry. People like Marc Cassavich at Stanford or Philippe Bouillet in Bordeaux in Paris, they are actually preparing such experiments, or they're doing such experiments with gravity measurements and gravity gradiometry for various applications, geodesic applications, like searching, as mentioned, for oil, for caves, submarine navigation, and various things. So with atom interferometers, that can be done, and the concept is exactly the same here. The reason why we don't do that is because our signal-to-noise technically is so much lower than for atoms, because it's so much more difficult to make a beam out of molecules. If we had a much, much more intense beam, we could also do it. It's the same formula, so to say, the same sensitivity for us and for the atom guys. They only have, that's a long way, huh? This one, no. One's back, sorry, here, this one. That is exactly the same phase shift formula for us and for the atom people, only that they have a much higher flux and smaller mass. Therefore, they have a higher, and since all masses fall the same in the gravitational field, it doesn't matter whether it's a big mass or a small mass, as long as you can measure its fall, and the phase shift is bigger for smaller mass. So for that reason, it seems still to be easier to do it with atoms, but we are sensitive.
In the mechanical grating experiments, can you explain in a little more detail why the van der Waals interaction doesn't leave behind which slit information and destroy the coherence?
Because it's a conservative potential. If you write it down, it's just a minus C3 over R cubed, so to say. There's no, there are virtual photons exchanged, but no real photons. And in that sense, there's no which path information left behind. You could imagine, for very thin gratings, and that is an open question, that you really have such a strong collision between the molecule and the wall, and if the wall is graphene only, very, very thin, that you excite phonons in this thing which propagate, but phonon wavelengths are very long, so they would not resolve the 100 nanometers probably. So it's more like exposing the molecules to a static electric field or magnetic field that also leaves the phase, well, it shifts the phase, but leaves the coherence intact. That is similar, I would say.
In some of the data you have presented, it's clear that the results are different from what is expected from classical physics. Still, there is some difference with from quantum mechanics. I'm thinking of, for example, the plot of interference for what you called the octopus molecule. So could one think that this is an evidence of slight violation of quantum mechanics? I mean, you have error bars there. But in this case,
the experimental interference is stronger than the theoretically expected. So that would going in the wrong direction. Huh? Having more interference in practice is not a violation of quantum mechanics. I would be cautious I would be cautious in over-interpreting the data. We had that already in 2003. There was also slight variation by a few percent of the expected interference contrast. But a few percent, you always have to give and take, so to say, because it could be that the slits, in this case, the first slit is a mechanical slit still, and the third one also, they could be a little bit distorted from the ideal, or there could be some molecules lying on the slit surface, so to say. That would modify things. I would rather think that this modifies the effect than that quantum mechanics has changed. If this here goes from 50% to 10% or below, then I would start wondering, but I would also first look for decoherence instead of anything else. But the deviation from the experiments triggered Charles Wang. I don't know, he's not here, but there was an article about him in The Economist 2 weeks ago. They had some ideas for testing space-time fluctuations with atom or molecule interferometers, and also setting up an experiment in England, it seems. And he came and said, well, you have a small deviation, so that must already be an indication for space-time fluctuations. And of course, that was a bit daring in the beginning. And I think they changed their model also by a few orders of magnitude.
Any further questions?
So I guess we're all excited about this experimental program and trying to understand how far and how fast it's going. Can, just very roughly, could you give some sort of analog to Moore's law in terms of matter interferometry? How much is the mass that we can interfere changing?
Depends on where you want to start. If you want to start with Estermann and Stern in 1930, then we're on a very steep exponential slope right now, huh?
Okay.
But if you start with our own experiments, it's about doubling the mass every 15, 18 months.
Okay.
But it has to be much faster, huh? And our funding agencies want us to be faster. Actually, I also want that.
Thank you very much.
The mic was coming, huh?
Yeah. Coming down.
Time interferometry one, you talked about the mass differences. So what happens? These molecules cluster together and they're acting as one big molecule?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the funny thing. So atoms clusters, if you wish, in a molecule, and then the molecules cluster in a cluster. Of course, we start already from anthracene clusters, anthracene molecules, and they cluster in the source to form bigger chunks.
Aren't those rather unstable and liable to fracture apart when you're doing this interferometry?
If you do it with anthracene, no, but we are actually trying to make a grating based on this phenomenon with the following idea. Not all organic molecules like to photoionize with a single photon, and therefore it would be difficult to do the virus interferometry with this kind of interferometer. Therefore, the idea is to maybe attach something which is only loosely bound to the shell, so to the outer shell of the, for instance, virus, and that a single photon may then suffice to release that, and that you can this way realize a depletion grating. And so our students played with a number of different molecules, and some fall apart, some attach heliums. It's still to be investigated. There's a lot of work to be done in the lab, but yeah, if you start from helium clusters, they would evaporate.
Okay, so why don't we thank Marcus again?